I am Dr. Art Klatz, a master's student at Oklahoma State University, and my project is kind of different from everyone else's. They've been getting to discover new things, whereas I'm looking at history and seeing how much improvement we've made. And by there, I feel like I may be a messenger of bad news, and I really hope not to be. But I'd really like to start with where we've come from in wheat breeding. Around 10,000 years ago, the first wheat selections began, where people were selecting wheat, wild wheat, for things that they could replant. And while we might not think of this as breeding today, this is definitely selection and kind of got our crop to where we had it up until the time of Mendel. And at that point, some breeding, some targeted breeding probably began. Breeding in the Great Plains really didn't start, though, until the last century, specifically around the 20s. We saw the introduction of Kharkov, which was a selection of Turkey Red. And then from that time, there were some small breeding with few advances, but really our largest advance came from Dr. Borlaug with the introduction of the semi-dwarf wheats. And this gave us a large yield jump. Dr. Klatz actually told me that this cultivar that you see here was one of the very first semi-dwarfs ever released, and it was Pinhama 62. So you can see a large change from these tall cultivars into the semi-dwarfs, and we've really advanced from that point also. And that's what I'd like to be talking to you about today. So what have we done since these semi-dwarfs? Obviously, we'd like to say that we're breeding for yield, but this might not be the case. A lot of times our yield increases come through adaptation and quality breeding. We have really stringent quality standards, which may hold us back. Also, we have to do breeding for disease and insect resistance to get some gains, but those may be more of a fighting the trend rather than gaining yield. So my justification of this study is that there have been some analyses worldwide that say that we've made about 1% per year yield increase, and this is compared to the old tall varieties. Those fall into about 16.2 to 18.8 kilograms per hectare worldwide, but no studies have analyzed the yield gain among semi-dwarf cultivars only. To test the gains that we've made in semi-dwarf cultivars, I used 30 historical cultivars ranging from 1919 to 2008, and those were planted in 11 locations across Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas for 2 years. I used a split block design where fungicide was applied to half the plots and not applied to the others, and then the 30 cultivars were replicated within or were randomized within the fungicide or no fungicide treatment. The fungicide was used to assess, to see what we've really been doing in yield gains while we exclude our breeding for disease resistance. We had some talks earlier about durable rust resistance and gene-for-gene type resistance, and we wanted to apply fungicide to see if we could tease out those differences between where our breeding has really been maintenance breeding versus where it was true yield gains. And today I'll be presenting about the regression analysis of yield by year of release. But there are some other cool projects that are going to come out of this study. Currently I'm doing some work with yield stability that looks like it's going to be very interesting. Also there's a yield component study and some molecular marker things going on with this data set. So my plot locations, like I said, there were 11 of them per year. Sweetwater, Oklahoma, this one here, was only in the first year, and Stillwater, the middle of these, was only in the second year. We tried to choose these to simulate the conditions that we see around the Great Plains. Our largest wheat growing areas are probably right through this region, but also there's wheat scattered through all of this and on into Colorado. We chose to exclude Colorado and northern Kansas because then you're getting into different limiting factors with the cold. So these trials that are near to each other, one of them is irrigated and one is not. Again, up here we have an irrigated and non-irrigated trial. And then in the Stillwater area, these were separated. The Lake Carl Blackwell site was able to be irrigated, and it was a heavy clay soil. The Perkins was a sandy soil, able to be irrigated, and the Stillwater was more of a loam soil. Here's an example of a plot that I would put out with the fungicide and no fungicide treatment on each replication, and the 30 varieties randomized within each replication. These 30 varieties represent kind of a historical picture of these cultivars. We start with Kharkov in 1919, then move to Triumph 64, and have semi-dwarf varieties from TAM 101 through 2008, through the rest of them. Additionally, there's four onless varieties in there, which kind of threw a little bit of a wrench in the plan, but were interesting to see. So my yields ranged from 6.5 kilograms per hectare to basically 5.5 tons of hectare, tons per hectare. And no, that Kharkov plot was not a damaged plot. That was just how bad it was in Vernon this year for a tall to be a tall variety. And it was interesting to see that Vernon, Texas was my lowest yielding this year because of the drought, and then the highest yielding last year. And there was great variability between the years and between the locations. So when you're looking at all of the yields for all the varieties regressed over time, this is really what Cox studied and what our previous studies have said, the 1% per year. This is like how, this is what the breeders have been saying, how are we doing and how much yield gains are we making. And the slope of increase where cultivar year of release is plotted by the yield is 14.5 kilograms per hectare per year. And this equates to 0.96% per year of the Kharkov yield. This means that the total increase we've made, basically from this point down to this point, was 1.3 tons in the past 89 years, or only 12.3 bushels of genetic yield increase. The slope, like I said, was 0.96% per year, and this falls right in line with everything people have been saying all along, 1% per year of Cox. So this validates the study that it's going the right way. This is what we've been finding. Now, when you exclude the tall varieties and you take out that big yield jump that we got from switching to semi-dwarf varieties from tall varieties, you're going to decrease your rate of gain. And this would be a better representative of the modern wheat breeding gains that we're making when you look at the yields of just with and without fungicide across the Great Plains of semi-dwarf varieties. The increase here was only 11.2 kilograms per hectare per year, which is equal to 0.43% of TAM 101 yield per year. So instead of 1%, we're down to 0.43% per year. This is a change of less than half a ton per the 37 years, 0.41 tons, or 6.2 bushels in genetic increase over the past 37 years. And so this is nice to see what we've been making, what is attainable on farmers' fields, and that's a change of 6.2 bushels from the cultivars that were released in 1971 to the cultivars that were released in 2008. But we'd really like to look at what's the actual genetic yield potential change, because this includes the breeding for leaf rust resistance and other diseases that we see in the Great Plains. And how we did that was by analyzing only the semi-dwarf cultivars that had been with fungicide applied to them. And this would represent our genetic yield gains without the influence of maintenance breeding or disease-resistance breeding, only pure genetic gain. And this represents 10.5 kilograms per hectare per year, or decreasing the slope even further to 0.37% per year of the TAM 101 yield. The total rise in genetic gain over that small point is 0.39 tons per hectare for the last 37 years, or 5.8 bushels over the last 37 years. All of these slopes were significant, and none of the slopes had a plateau. So these are actual genetic gains we're making. They're linear. We expect them to continue, but they may not be what we've been thinking that they were. So that's kind of disheartening. Some things that may be holding us back with making further improvements in the wheat genetic gains are disease resistance, including adult plant resistance or durable rust resistance breeding into our schemes may free up some more of our time to increase our potential for yields. And also quality standards are really stringent. Like one of our former presenters showed, there's only a tiny little bit controlling the quality for baking, and you either have it or you don't. So you have to maintain that tight bit of germplasm to keep that quality, which may be hard to increase yield. But something needs to be done, and I know CIMMYT is working with yield increase breeding, and there may be hope with the GMOs coming soon. It'll be interesting to see where this progresses forward from this point. With that, I'd like to acknowledge Dr. Art Klatt. He couldn't be here today. All the students who helped me plant the trials and harvest them. Additionally, I have quite a few cooperators, Dr. Jeff Edwards and Dr. Brett Carver from Oklahoma State, Texas A&M, Jackie and Ravindra at Bushland and Jason, Chillicothe, Kansas State, Dr. Alan Fritz, AgriPro, Dr. Dave Worrell, and Michael Chopa, corresponded with me quite a bit, and from Westbred, Dr. Sid Perry. With that, I'd take any questions you have. Okay, so Kharkov was yielding about 1.5 tons, where TAM 101 here is yielding about 2 tons. It does account for a little bit of the difference in percent. Some of it's a misnomer with the. So you're looking at 11 kilograms per hectare compared to 2 tons, or 10 kilograms per hectare compared to 2 tons, instead of looking at 14.5 kilograms per hectare compared to 1.5 tons. Oh. Jackie?
2010 to 2011 were 2 years, right?
Mm-hmm. Extremely different.
Did you measure genetic gain within, only looking at 2010 data and looking only at 2011 data?
We looked at only 2010 and only 2011, and they weren't significantly different, so we pooled them. The slope continued no matter which yield level you were at. It was pretty much the same slope, and we found that also with stability. So that's where the interesting information is coming in with stability. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, one more question.
Do all the worms descend from Norton, or do you have other sources of semi-dwarf?
That I'm not exactly familiar with. The question about where the semi-dwarf parent came from for all of the varieties, I'm not certain.
One more question, Josh.
What's the other half?
The other half of the plant, meaning?
The roots.
The roots. Well, there was an NUE study done with some of these varieties through Kansas State, and that's something to look at. I, they haven't done a NUE over time. They just did NUE by variety. I think they are going to look in that over time. And we did not take root mass of the plants. We only took above ground biomass. I would say that's right.
Okay, let's thank our speaker.